Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show that gets you thinking here on Premier Christian Radio. It's Unbelievable, a show that regularly brings together Christians and non-Christians for discussion and debate. And we've got a cracker of a show lined up for you today, as we had last week, as I continue to chat with my special guest over from the States at the moment, Victor Stenger, a US physicist and an atheist and author of God, the Failed Hypothesis. Let me tell you, though, what we're talking about on today's program. You're unbelievable. Well, in conversation with Victor this week is David Bartholomew, who is a Christian himself. He's the Emeritus Professor of Statistics at the London School of Economics. And he is due shortly to publish a paper critiquing Victor's work, particularly in regards to his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis, which we've been looking at across these 2 weeks. We're going to find out why David objects to the way Victor uses data and statistics in making his case against God. And it'll throw up all kinds of questions like, can we, you know, analyze scientifically things like whether intercessory prayer works? What about, if you like, putting God in the test tube in this way? Is it even valid to do that in the first place? So we should have a fascinating show on our hands, as we always do here on the show, that gets you thinking. Unbelievable, right through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. Well, gentlemen, it's wonderful to have you both in the studio with me. Victor, you're back again. So thank you for joining us again. Victor,
yeah, it's fun to be here.
You've had a lot of response to this book, The Failed Hypothesis, God, The Failed Hypothesis. It came out a few years ago now.
2007, yes.
So tell us, why do you think people are so interested in this? Why did it make the New York Times bestseller list and things like that?
Well, it helped by coming out with a series, soon after a series of other books appeared. That, in fact, have been labeled the new atheism, starting with Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith. Then he also wrote a follow-up to that,
Letter to a Christian Nation.
Mm-hmm. Then there was Richard Dawkins' huge bestseller.
We've heard of that, yes, The God Delusion.
God Delusion. It's, I saw him the other day in Copenhagen, and he mentioned to me that it's now sold 3 million copies in English alone.
Wow, so, extraordinary!
And he was kind enough to do a jacket blurb for my book. So people, I think, saw Richard Dawkins on the front there, and they said, "Well, maybe we'll take a look at this." And that helped a lot. I also got a nice blurb from Sam Harris, and then in the paperback edition that came later. I got Christopher Hitchens, who had written another one of these bestseller books, to do the do forward. So I had these all these.
You had at least three
guys,
of the four horsemen, as
them,
it were.
I had them right. So
well, I mean, obviously, you're part of that wave then of new atheist literature that's coming out. Obviously, yours not so much a rhetorical sort of attack as in the way that Hitchens is and Sam Harris to some extent, but much more trying to take put your scientific mind to the question of God, and you treat God in many ways as just another hypothesis to be tested, and that if we look at the observational data, we can draw the reasonable conclusion that God does not exist. And in fact, one way of summing that up, as we mentioned on the show last week, is this statement: not only does the universe show no evidence for God, but it looks exactly as it would be expected to look if there is no God. That kind of encapsulates where you're coming from, I think.
Yes, that's right. That's a summary.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us again on the program. Now, new to this program altogether is David Bartholomew. David, as I mentioned, a Christian himself, and he's Emeritus Professor of Statistics at the London School of Economics. Thank you for joining us today, David. Have you sort of always been a Christian? Have you ever had any conflicts between your beliefs and the academic kind of circles you run in?
Well, I've been a Christian and a statistician, as I said, as long as I can remember, which means roughly to the age of 18. You know, before that, one has only very vague memories. I've had a number of posts, and I've always insisted on being statistics, not biological statistics or any other kind. But I think in the context of this discussion, I'd like to call it statistical science, because essentially I regard myself as a scientist. The sort of statistician I am is concerned with drawing inferences from data, where there's uncertainty. And it was basically because modern statistics is based on probability theory that I really got into this field. When I was, an undergraduate, Charles Coulson was Ralph Ball Professor of Mathematics at Oxford, and I heard him talk on a number of occasions. I've never had occasion to refer to his work, but he was very influential. He had thought quite seriously about these subjects, and I thought I would as well. And partly I think there's a consistency in one's own thinking. You can't keep whatever beliefs you have and how you practice your trade in separate compartments. So I was always interested in bringing them together. And I hadn't read all Victor's books. I read some of them. And in particular, God, the Failed Hypothesis, which particularly caught my attention because I won't say it's a statistics book, but he uses statistical methods to test the hypothesis of God's existence. And he argues that if God is present and active in the world, it ought to be detectable. There have been, I think, you say, Victor, millions or maybe trillions of prayers, and there ought to be some sign that they've had an effect. And therefore, if one can collect the right data and subject them to appropriate scientific analysis, we should be able to test this hypothesis. So that's how I came at this thing.
Last week, Victor said that in his experience, most scientists who do have a faith sort of have a left and right kind of partitioning of the brain or something, where they do their science in the lab and they go to church and they're doing something completely different, and they never the twain really exist together. Is that the way it works for you, or is it different?
Not really, because a statistician doesn't have a lab. You're a kind of consultant to all sorts and conditions of other scientists, not very often from the physics end of the spectrum, most commonly biology, psychology, which is where I'm working now, and the social sciences generally. And that is very much more difficult.
But is there, in a sense, a compartmentalization? Perhaps we could call it non-overlapping magisteria or whatever term we want to call it. You know, this idea that your faith is one thing and your scientific approach is different, and the two really, you know, don't have any bearing.
No,
on each
that's
other.
Not the way it is. I mean, for practical purposes, you do certain things at certain times.
Sure.
But always, I would think, you do one with the other in the back of your mind.
If you are listening and you'd like to weigh in, you'd like to perhaps give your opinion on anything you hear, perhaps respond yourself to the issues we're looking at today, then it would be great to hear from you via the email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to phone your voicemail comment in, then you can do that at the voicemail line for the show, which is 08456 52 52 52 and select option 8. And we'll be hearing some of your responses to last week's show between Victor and Steve Fuller, which was, it was a lively encounter, I'll say that much. And we'll see what your reactions to it were towards the end of the programme today. In the meantime, if you want to hear that programme, and indeed you want to listen again to this or to let someone else know about it, don't forget the web address of Unbelievable, where you can download the podcast. You can send on the show to other people. You can find out more about the show and the characters we have on here. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Again, premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So, David, your paper is due to be published, I think, in the Science and Christian Belief Journal that's associated with the Faraday Institute. You start off looking at one of the types of sets of data that Victor uses in his belief that God is a failed hypothesis. But in particular, this one about does intercessory prayer work? So maybe to start us off with why you feel Victor's approach, where you feel the flaws are in the way Victor tries to tackle the whole area.
Well, I hope Victor will interrupt me if I haven't characterized his position properly, but I think he's arguing there ought to be empirically detectable signs of God's action in the world, and these ought to be measurable and testable by the methods of science. I think the intercessory prayer is a very good example, because one can identify what it is being prayed for, and in the case of the medical application, which is the usual one that's been discussed, there are clear signs of whether it's worked. And if I can come to my conclusion first, my conclusion is that the experiment that, or the two experiments I think described in the book, actually don't deliver the goods, and perhaps I should explain why. I mean, there are many so-called experiments on the efficacy of intercessory prayer, and I think Stenger and Victor calls them anecdotal, and I'm inclined to agree with them. They haven't been controlled. And again, if I'm right, I think he regards the double-blind randomized trial as the gold standard for doing this thing.
Now, for those who are not familiar with those terms, what is a double-blind randomized trial when it's...
Well, the term is used primarily in clinical studies where you're testing a new drug. You want to know whether it works. So the basic idea is you give the drug to some people and you don't give it to the others, and if it works, there's a difference. But there are problems in doing this because... if a person knows they're getting the drug, it may affect their reaction. It's well known that people react to sugar pills that have the placebo effect. So you have to make sure the patient doesn't know whether they're getting the dummy or the real thing. It's also possible that the person administering the drug will convey by even their actions something which gives a clue as to what is happening, and that may...
Again, influence the result.
They may influence the... Then you have to apply it to two groups. Now, people react to drugs very differently. So if you happen to have one highly reactive group and one unreactive group, the difference would be due to the people and not due to the drug. So you mix them up in what's called a randomized trial. You basically allocate them at random so there can be no known bias. And then if the treatment group comes out best, you've got pretty definite evidence. And that's how clinical trials work.
And this is the way that science works. This is, you know, what we might define as a scientific approach to gaining the evidence so that it's unbiased.
You control everything you can, and what you can't control, you basically randomize so that nothing out there that you haven't thought of has a serious effect. Now, as I understand, Victor, there are two what I'll call prayer trials, which meet all the requirements of a valid test. People are invited to pray for the recovery of a group. I think some other non-physical, but as it were, non-spiritual things were tried as well. But again, that's not very relevant. Now, the answer to this was that there was no significant difference between the recovery rate or whatever of those who are prayed for and those who are not. There are other variations in the design. It might matter whether people know they're being prayed for and that sort of thing, but I don't think that affects the principle, what we're saying. Now, I have two objections to the conclusion drawn from that. One is that the prayer study does not exactly match the clinical study, because in the clinical study there are two parties. There's the patient and the people dealing with the patient. In the prayer trial, there are three parties, and one is God. Now, you have to allow that God might be a party, otherwise you're not doing the experiment. And it seems to me quite unjustified to suppose that God will be manipulated by our prayers. If he were, he wouldn't be God in the sense that I understand him. And therefore, if I had been funding this study, I said there's no way we're going to get a conclusive answer out of this.
This is where I'd like to step in,
let me just say because it hasn't been stated that the two studies you reference showed that there was no apparent effect of prayer. That was the result that was drawn.
Before we go on, let me first ask you: are you questioning my conclusion, or are you questioning the conclusions of the authors of these studies?
Your conclusion.
Right.
I mean, I just quote
some numbers here, p-values and so on, sort of thing that I am quite familiar from my own research, used them all my life, but always in more of a heuristic way than in an exact statistical way. It's just that we have, in physics, we have our own kind of rule.
We may get round to that later.
Yeah, if you get a p-value of 1 in 10,000, then you're safe.
This is a probability value.
Yeah, well, it's this... it has to do with what's the probability that a random event would give you the result you observe, or a greater result. But, crudely what it is.
Well, what do you make, though, of the basic point that David's making, first of all, which is that you've kind of... It's not equivalent to a clinical test because you have to assume that God is involved.
I thought I made it clear that... That's why I wanted to look at what I actually said, that certainly... If you get a negative result, you can explain it away by just saying, well, God just didn't happen to think that these people deserved to. He has the right to do that. He's God, after all. He can do whatever he wants. And my argument is that, nevertheless, if the result had been positive, people would have jumped upon it. So if you say that there's no way for such an experiment to be conclusive, I disagree. I think that the experiment would be one way that you could show that God exists. If you found that you did a series of experiments of this sort, very, very well conducted experiments that all the skeptics look at and agree with that have been done right, and you get a definitely strong statistical significant result that's also replicable by other people, and you find that, for example, that only Catholic prayers worked and Protestant prayers didn't work and Hindu prayers didn't work, then you would have to conclude, I couldn't think of any natural explanation for that result, and so I would have to conclude this pretty good evidence that maybe there is a God after all out there and that the Catholics had it right all along.
Okay.
So I think that would be a positive a way in which God could be detected.
Now that brings me to my second objection. What would we have concluded had there been a positive result? Say a big... Then I would argue you still couldn't conclude that God is acting there. Or at least... You might conclude that there was some kind of external being who was influencing things and was doing what you asked them to do.
Yes. That's why I bring up the specific case of where. I mean, it's like any other experiment. You try to. It might take a whole series of experiments to pin down the details once you have a positive result. And then you find, oh, this kind of prayer works and this kind of prayer doesn't work. Well, then you'd really gradually. Zero in on the supernatural hypothesis.
Well, let's bring the paranormal into it, because if that result had occurred, every paid-up atheist would have jumped in and said, well, that's not God, that's something that we don't understand about the universe. Mm-hmm. You can actually... It's a mind-over-matter thing. Now, I know you don't approve of that either, but that is a possible explanation, and that would always be in the background as a possible explanation.
That's right. That's why every physicist in the country, in all countries, would jump at the opportunity to start doing experiments on this. First of all, they would get funded. Funding would be easy. And believe me, I was a research scientist for 40 years, and there's nothing more important to a research scientist than his funding. It makes his whole life possible. So they would jump at the opportunity to pursue this further, and there would be plenty of opportunities, and eventually you would zero in. You'd like in any other kind of experiment, you'd zero in on the properties of the phenomenon that you're observing.
What's your ultimate point there, though, David? That our worldview will always, in some sense, bias what we take away from.
Yes, are you saying that this is impossible? That this would not be a feasible outcome of.
I don't think you could establish the existence or the non-existence of God by this kind of experiment. You could produce some relevant information, which have to go into the arguments. But let me give you another example from astrology, which I know you don't believe in either. But it's alleged by astrologers that the birth sign affects the kind of person you are. Now, in France, as I understand it, they record the time of birth, and therefore it's possible to determine in principle under what sign you were born. And people are quite seriously investigated this to see whether people, whether they call it the Mars effect, whether people born under the sign of Mars are more warlike or whatever Mars is held to be. Now, most of these things don't come out significant, but that particular one does. Now, that hasn't made me believe in astrology because there are other explanations. I don't know what the explanation is, but my guess is that knowing that you're born under Mars and knowing this is supposed to make you whatever, warlike or whatever, you'll more likely turn to military occupations or whatever. And that is a possible explanation. I don't know whether it's right. It doesn't matter whether it's right. All that matters is there is another explanation there. So that's
a good example of a non-double-blind experiment.
I mean,
that would not be a good experiment by your own
That's
measures.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, but they were very large numbers because a very large number of I don't believe in astrology because of that. Mm-hmm. And as you indicate, there are other weaknesses in the design of that, which you would want to call into question if you got down to that level.
Yeah.
What I'm merely saying is that if you get an effect, you can't attribute it necessarily to God or the paranormal or whatever you want.
So in, essentially, what we've come round to is that David is suggesting that in this specific example, and you take this kind of a symptomatic of the way Victor treats his the way he incorporates God into these kind of analyses generally, that you can't do that and get anything that tells you really anything about God, because we're simply not in a position if God is a third party.
I totally disagree. I mean, I thought I just gave you a very specific example of how the existence of God would be proven to my satisfaction. I'll tell you, if those Catholic prayers were the only prayers that worked, I was baptized as a Catholic, so I'd be ready to go right back to the Catholic Church. I'd go find the nearest church, go down to the confessional. They bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been 50 years since my last confession, and I would be back in the fold.
So, what's your reaction to that, David? I mean, would you kind of, if there was a positive result, say, okay, God does exist. I mean, what Victor's accusing you of here is in a sense, hypocrisy, that if it were positive, you would say yes, and if, as it's negative, you say, well, we just don't know what God would do in circumstances, so it doesn't make sense to test.
No, I'm saying we don't know in either case. I mean, I wouldn't have funded one of those studies if anyone had asked me for £2.5 million, because I had said at the outset, you're not going to get a clear answer. It may be worth doing for other reasons.
I mean, I suppose Victor's offering this as a thought experiment. What if it had given a clear indication that all Catholics' prayers were answered?
I would say that the people doing these experiments certainly disagreed with you, I'm sure. They thought, and incidentally, most of the people doing these experiments are believers, people like Harold Koenig at Duke University, who's the head of a whole institute that's devoted to searching for connections between religion and health, a fellow that I know a little bit because I've communicated with him by email, at least. I've never met him personally, and I find he's a fine, honest, excellent scientist. And I think people like him who are doing this work are really, they're believers, and they really want to show that God exists. That's their motivation. But at the same time, and I have the greatest respect for them, because they go where the data goes. They are not trying to cheat in any way. They just are willing to be good scientists and go wherever the data goes. And I have absolutely no complaint about them at all.
Well, I think they're wrong. If they would have been, if their experiment had been successful in the terms we're talking about, mm-hmm. and they had concluded that proves there is God, I'd have said you can't conclude that. It may be true, and what you're observing may be what God is doing. Though I'd be a bit disturbed if God was somebody who responded to my pulling strings, mm-hmm. Which there are a lot of people who think, and one of my former colleagues was involved in a sequential experiment where they prepared in sequence and stopped. And I think in scientific terms, it was a waste of time.
You seem to have a theological belief here that God wouldn't react. He wouldn't be willing to show his presence by way of giving a positive result in the prayer test. Is that what you're kind of implying?
That's right,
here?
Yes. Yeah.
That's the God that hides from us.
Yes.
Okay? And there are very good arguments against such a God. There are several philosophical arguments called the hiddenness argument, that God could hide himself from us and there's just nothing. I mean, everybody agrees there's no scientific evidence for God. If there was scientific evidence for God, it would be in the textbooks along with the scientific evidence for neutrinos and quarks and DNA and everything else. But it isn't. And so why isn't there? Well, God is obviously, he could be hiding from us. And the argument is that such a God cannot exist. Such a God cannot exist who is the God that most people worship, namely a God who is omniscient, omnibenevolent, and, you know, and what's the third choice?
Omnipotent. Yeah. Well, all the omnipotent.
Omnipotent. Yeah. And such a God, first of all, a good God. A good God, a moral God, would not deliberately hide himself from people who are open to the possibility.
Okay, so for God to play fair, he should at least cooperate with our scientific experiments. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, he shouldn't deliberately hide from us if we really are searching for him.
I mean, what do you make of this, Dave? Because obviously, you come with an assumption about the character of God, and so does Victor here, who says, "Well, if God is the God you claim he is, then he should be upfront with his existence and not sort of try to subvert my experiments on intercessory prayer."
I'm not saying that God hides himself in, I think, the way Victor is talking about. What all I'm claiming at the moment is that one cannot be certain of his presence by scientific experiment, double blind or whatever. In other words, you can't put God to the test in that kind of way, and you shouldn't expect to.
Why not?
Because if you could, God wouldn't be God, in my understanding.
I mean,
God is not subject to my whims and fancies.
To take it to a biblical level, it was, of course, Jesus who said that. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, when he's asked to do that very thing by Satan in the wilderness. But that biblical reference aside, we're going to...
Saint Paul also said God is detectable. So, you can find any answer to anything in the Bible.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, gents, and we'll be back in just a moment. We'll get more into this as the show progresses, because this isn't obviously the only area that you focus on in your critique of Victor's work here, David. So we'll continue in a moment. David Bartholomew joins me today in conversation with Victor Stenger, as we look at the question of whether God is a failed hypothesis, as Victor's book claims. And as I said, we'll have links to both my guests and how you can find out more about them and the organisations they represent. David Bartholomew's paper, shortly to come out in the Science and Christian Belief Journal, says that essentially Stenger has sort of used scientific sampling in an invalid way to make his case, and we'll hear more from David on why he believes that in a short moment's time. So do stay tuned to the show that gets you thinking here on Premier Christian Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show, and in conversation today, atheist US physicist Victor Stenger is with me, author of God, the Failed Hypothesis, a New York Times bestseller, and last year he wrote another book, The New Atheism, Taking a Stand for Science and Reason. He believes that science and reason have really put the idea of God to bed. David Bartholomew begs to differ. He's a Christian, he's Emeritus Professor of Statistics at the London School of Economics And he's recently written a paper due to be published shortly critiquing Stenger's way that he uses data to suggest that God is a failed hypothesis. We'll also look in this section of the programme at whether Stenger, well, Victor, why use surnames, eh? whether Victor takes the Christian view of God seriously. That's something that David is keen to point out, that he feels that Victor pays very little attention to what Christians actually believe about God and Jesus. And that's important when we're actually undertaking any kind of scientific endeavour to find out whether this God exists. So, gentlemen, let's continue from more or less where we left off. More in general, we've been talking about these studies on intercessory prayer and why you object to them being in any way used as evidence for or against God, David. But you feel that in general, the way Victor uses sampling in the book, there's a kind of he's scientific when it comes to science, but not very scientific when it comes to other data. So you quote the fact that he says the empirical fact is that people with no religion are not noticeably less charitable than those with religion, and you have a concern that there is a tendency among scientists, and perhaps Richard Dawkins does similar things in The God Delusion, to kind of become rather unscientific when they start talking about what they perceive to be the effect of religion or these things. And we need to approach that in just as much a scientific way. Why are you concerned about that particularly?
Well, the particular example you quoted is one among many one which could find in the literature, which are basically comparing Christian people with non-Christian people and arguing that the difference is what isn't what you would expect it to be. Now, I argue that Victor departs from his scientific creed when he gets onto that. He merely says it's an empirical fact. He doesn't give any references, whether it relates to American adults, how many non-respond, and so on. There are a whole series of questions which a statistician would want to ask before doing that. I mean, Richard Dawkins has a rather notorious example where he says only 3% of fellows of the Royal Society believe in God or something, until you look at the size of his sample and the response and the fact that people, you know, there are questions of that kind which have to be answered. And I feel that scientists should be scientific across the board. And that's a good example that you quoted.
And you feel there's a double standard at work there. What's your response?
Well,
to that?
It's anecdotal to use Victor's name.
Well, in all my books, I try to be very accurate with my references and so on. And I may have missed one occasionally, but I really do try to make when I make a statement, a factual statement that is based on documentation, I really make a strong attempt to reference that. I go to a lot of trouble. And if you look at my books, you'll see the huge bibliography. So if I missed something, I'd be happy to correct that. I'd be happy to put that reference in the next edition if you just point it out to me where I say something without a reference.
Well, you didn't give a reference, but we're all like that. But I'm saying that is fairly typical of what I call the new atheists. That one standard appears to apply, for example, when they talk about what people... Now, measuring charitability is a major problem in itself. I'm not aware that anyone has done it. You have to define what you mean. Measuring variables of this kind is a nightmare.
But we're not using that to argue there's no God. We're just using that as a defense to some extent, because there are so many people, especially in America, maybe you don't probably run into it here the way we do there, where you will have people on Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, some of the authors that are out there like Ann Coulter, people like Pat Robertson, who make statements that if we had atheism, if we didn't have religion, everybody would be going around killing everybody else, and it would be a miserable world of hatred and violence. And yet there's no evidence for that. There's no evidence that atheists are any worse than anybody else. There are countries like the Scandinavian countries where God belief is very low, and like Britain now where God belief is getting lower and lower. There's no evidence that has changed the moral fiber of people in any way. And that's the only point we're trying to make there.
David, I mean, ultimately, in a sense, that's more of a critique of the general approach here. Perhaps not, it doesn't sort of refer directly to whether Victor's thesis is wrong or not. But going back to this intercessory prayer studies, etc., in what is there just a general sense that you don't feel Victor's approach is valid? That I mean, I'm getting the feeling that you're suggesting when it comes to a concept like God, you can't analyze God in the way that Victor hopes to be doing, that you know, to be looking for empirical data and testing it and then coming to conclusions. You believe it just doesn't make sense to treat God in the same way as we would treat any material phenomena.
Well,
that we're
I
trying
can't
to
think of any experiment which could be conducted or any observational data which be collected which wouldn't be open to the kind of objections I've raised on the medical one. I mention that because that's very clear cut. There's a clear measure of success. It's very easy to observe what is happening. It's very easy to put in controls to make sure that nothing funny is happening. But if I could go back to his example.
No, but I mean, I disagree with you 100%. I gave you a precise example of how God could have been discovered by just such an experiment, by finding that only one kind of prayer works, then you would have, and that prayer happened to correspond to one of the great faiths and not to any of the others, you could draw no other conclusion that particular faith was the correct faith after all. I don't see how you have provided me with any answer to that.
If it were the case, as you hypothesize, that only Catholic prayers worked, that Catholics were in some sense had a special relationship which made God listen to them. Mm-hmm. If you presented me the result of an experiment with that result, I say there's something very funny going on here. I wouldn't immediately jump to the conclusion that God had a special spot in his heart for Catholics or whoever.
Oh, I think a lot of scientists would say, well, that can't be right. And you'd have a long period of trying to confirm this or disconfirm it. It wouldn't happen overnight, certainly. I don't see how you still...
That we don't have any such result. All we have is something which, as far as David's concerned, doesn't actually tell us anything because it's misconceived from its outset. I mean...
Well, it just adds to the body of knowledge that we have. By itself, it doesn't prove God doesn't exist, but it adds to the body of knowledge that God does not exist.
So there's a cumulative case here.
Every time you look at look for some sign, the sign isn't there, and there should be some sign there someplace.
Do you agree with this concept that Victor has of God, that with a God who is, in theory, supporting the universe and every particle within it, that there should be some sign, scientifically testable sign of his existence? I mean, some would say that we have, if you like, we can make conclusions on the basis, and this is another area that Victor's been looking at, of things like the fine-tuning of the universe, etc., where we can conclude that there must be an agency at work in some way. But, I mean, is that something that you would say is a kind of scientific way of proving God in any way, David, yourself, or do you just feel that this is where science can't help us when it comes to disproving or proving
in
God?
A strict sense, I think science can't. I think there is a vast amount of evidence out there. I mean, Victor says that quite rightly, that if God is the kind of God that Christians believe him to be, he must be doing something. The question is whether you can detect that by controlled scientific experiments or not, or whether it has to rest on an accumulation of what I think we would both call anecdotal evidence, because in the nature of the case, that's the only evidence we've got.
No, I would disagree. I have absolutely no confidence whatsoever in anecdotal evidence. I wouldn't rely on it for anything so important as such an issue. I would expect...
But I'm claiming you do use anecdotal evidence when it suits. And I mentioned that example of the... whether Christians are more charitable or not than others.
No, but that's not part of my argument against the existence of God.
Well, why did you put it in the book, then?
To help defend atheism to some extent.
I mean, you perhaps it's time to move the discussion on, gentlemen, to the fact that you, towards the end of your paper, David, you suggest that Stenger, in Victor, in the way that he conceptualizes God and the kind of God that he is looking to find or disprove, that you say he doesn't understand the core theology of the Christian God, and that's essential. Tell us a bit about this and why you feel that there's a problem here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I haven't read all the New Atheism books, but I've read many of them. And I get the impression that they all define religion as a set of propositions. Basically, you can write down a set of propositions describing the person of God and other things as well, and then you go around looking to see whether they're falsified. I don't think Christianity or any other religion, as far as I know, I speak of Christianity, which is the one I know, is about a set of propositions. I don't believe creeds are where you start. I think creeds are where you end. That's speaking very loosely. You don't say to a person, believe A, B, C, and D, and then you're in. No one has ever said that to me, and I'm not aware of any Christian group in this country that would say that.
That's the foundation of Christianity.
No, it isn't.
What was that creed back in 330?
Three or 400. It took them 400 years to get all that down in some agreed for. Even then they fought over it because it's so difficult.
And I remember having to recite the Apostles' Creed and so on. And I know that I happened to be interested in what Sarah Palin's religion was, and I looked it up. The Pentecostal religion, and there's a big creed that they have to read. I believe in this, and I believe
in
that.
I say creeds, but that is the point I've come to. I find they pretty fairly expressed. You want to argue about all the bits.
Look,
language is language.
You're a sophisticated thinker, and you're undoubtedly. I'll admit, we'll cut short the story, that the God of the theologians, the God of people who really have made a lifetime of studying the issue, is much more sophisticated and much more interesting in a lot of ways. But that's not the God that the new atheists were writing about. The new atheists have been writing about the God that most people worship, which is a very simple picture of a God that talks to them, a God that provides them with comforts and life ever after, and so on. That's the God that we were concerned with when we were writing about. In my book, Quantum Gods, I did get into the God of the theologians, including a God of your own theological tendencies.
Tell us then exactly, David, why you feel that Victor has mischaracterized the God that you believe in.
Well, the short answer is that he's on the outside and I'm on the inside. And that's a matter of free choice. And if you're on the inside of anything, the world looks differently. If you're on the inside of a marriage, it looks different to if you're outside, particularly if you've made a lifelong commitment. You can't know what that is like unless you've done it. And you can't know what it's like to be a Christian unless you are one.
So it's subjective, and I'm not concerned about the subjective beliefs of people. I'm concerned about the objective reality of a superpower, a super being out there that's beyond all reason.
But you dismiss subjectivity as if it's unimportant.
In what sense is it important, David?
Because I'm me. I mean,
you can believe whatever you want. I mean, you're absolutely, totally within your rights to believe with anything you want, and I'm not going to even try to talk you out of them. But that doesn't bear at all on the existence of God, the issue that is at hand.
I don't see why it doesn't bear on the existence of God, because God is not purely objective in any sensible theology. Or God is not experienced purely objective.
Okay, maybe there are, you know, such aspects of God, but I'm not talking again from a scientific point of view.
I mean,
if it's not objectivity that we're dealing with, then I don't have anything to say about it.
I mean, you seem to take issue with the way that Victor treats how Jesus Christ relates to God in Christian theology. You say that in the book, you reference the one remark that that Victor makes, which is, in other words, God does not wish to spend eternity with all human souls, but only the chosen few who, by blind faith in the absence of all evidence, accept a Jewish carpenter who may or may not have lived 2,000 years ago as their personal saviour. Of course, this is hardly a new idea, but was essentially the teaching of John Calvin. And you say that that statement makes it abundantly clear that Victor doesn't understand the core theology of the Christian God. Now, why do you feel it's so important that Victor does grasp this concept? Why is it important for him to realise this concept of God? Why is his science lessened by the fact that he doesn't engage with that type of a...
Well, ultimately, because it affects the whole way that you look at life. But to go back to something Victor said earlier, he said this was all... I can't remember what the phrase was. Faith, I think, was the word. They had no roots in... Now, I don't think you can build Christianity on historical evidence, but there is a lot, Victor. Very few people dispute that Jesus existed. Even Richard Dawkins, you know, atheists for Jesus, or Jesus for atheists, I forget which way it goes. There are one or two people who've written books arguing that he didn't exist.
I'm not using the argument that that Jesus didn't exist. I put it the way I did, which I think is accurate. He may or may not have existed. There's some possibilities, however slim. And you can't use the argument from authority. That doesn't do any good. I mean, he either existed or he didn't, independent of what people have written about the subject. But the fact is that there was nothing written about him for 40 years after his life. We have to rely on the stories that these people got, however they did, by
oral
testimony and so on. And you have to admit that has to have some unreliability to it. And that's all I'm saying. That it's not very reliable. The whole story. I rely a lot on Bart Ehrman's interpretations.
I think we don't want to too much digress into an argument over whether
right, especially since that's not I don't want to claim that I'm a biblical scholar.
And we've done many a show on that in other areas. But the point here, David, is it something along the lines of the fact that you feel that there is that even though you don't build the case for Christianity purely on the historical evidence, there is a historical basis on which Christians make their claims about Jesus and who he was and who he said he was. And you seem to be... The impression I get is that you don't feel that Stenger is... Victor is prepared even for a minute to take seriously those kinds of... Not in the sense scientifically, in the sense of the physicist science, but of a sociological type of science, which asks... Could it be that, in this context, those claims about Jesus' miracles and his resurrection, etc., were true? Is that where you're coming from?
I think you've got it exactly right, Jess.
So the sense is when scientists like Victor and Dawkins say, well, it's neither here nor there, all those stories about Jesus dying and rising again, you would say, well, that's not a very scientific approach. Why didn't you actually go and look at the evidence? And
well, if there were evidence, that would be wonderful. I mean, I love the... I think it was Dawkins who came up with the suggestion that suppose the bones of Jesus were discovered someday in Palestine, and that they were identifiable one way or the other by DNA or whatever, as the actual bones of Jesus Christ. What a wonderful thing that would be, because on one hand you'd have evidence that he existed, but on the other hand you'd have a violation of the idea that he rose bodily to heaven.
So, exactly, but I mean, there are...
It could be evidence.
We regularly debate the evidence in just such a way. We don't obviously have physical evidence like that, but we have the evidence of what the early Christians believed and why they would have believed that, and would it have made sense for them to believe that in those situations. And there are many... Yeah. Good scholars
but
who
you
say
also have,
this is very good evidence
have,
for
have
the resurrection.
Strong evidence, I think, against the fact that against the notion that there was a crucifixion in Jerusalem at that time, because there were Roman historians who should have written about it. You have strong evidence, strong archaeological evidence now that's, I think, irrefutable that the Exodus never happened, that Moses, the Moses story is a myth. And Moses' story is fundamental to all three Abrahamic religions. So you have lots of stuff out there that
I'm sure all these things can be debated. I mean, yeah. I suppose at the core of it, though, is can we apply the scientific... Are you willing to even look at those kinds of claims?
You bet.
Because are you, though? I mean, have you sat down and said to yourself, well, I'm going to...
I've looked at a lot of them. I'm a physicist. I'm interested in physical evidence, not arguments such as, well, you know, these disciples must have really believed or else they wouldn't have given their lives. An argument like that, I think, is foolish because Japanese kamikaze pilots gave their lives, soldiers gave their lives to Hitler. Those kinds of arguments,
sure.
I think,
well, that's the point, though. But you're engaging with an argument. The problem is, surely, that we can't give you a physical argument now because we're 2,000 years after the event.
Exactly.
Now, does that mean that automatically, because it goes against the laws of nature, it's therefore ruled out of court for you?
No, it's not ruled out. Maybe someday somebody will find something, of course.
I mean, for you, David, though, presumably that the inquiry is more than just inquiry into physics. We have to make arguments on the best knowledge we have.
I think you have to arrive at it beyond the totality of your experience. And hard science is part of that, and it's revolutionized the way we think. We wouldn't be here doing this in the absence of scientific thinking. And what I'm trying to do is to make sense of my total experience, and my total experience includes a great deal that Victor's not concerned with, because it's not physical science.
It's also your personal experience. It's subjective. It's believe me, I get into arguments exactly like this with many scientists who are believers, and they bring up all these irrelevant matters, namely, I love my wife, so therefore there must be a God. I mean, that's the kind of argument people make. Well, I can't love my wife because I'm an atheist, but believe me, I hear those types of arguments.
Is it irrelevant? I remember in a when John Lennox and Richard Dawkins debated in Oxford, and when John Lennox brought up the issue of Jesus Christ and his resurrection, Dawkins essentially, again, dismissed it and said, well, that's just some story about a backwater peasant who, we have a few stories about, and that's it. I think Christians get a bit frustrated when scientists who claim to examine everything with the rigor that they do then dismiss where there is actually a great deal of work and time and scholarly sort of input has gone into actually examining whether these things happened or not. And is there a problem here that because you've got your atheist worldview, you say, well, that stuff I know didn't happen?
I mean, we're open-minded at every level. Richard Dawkins gets carried away sometime and says extreme things. But I think that I have had an amateur interest in the question of Jesus Christ all my life, and I've read a lot of stuff on it. But it just doesn't make sense to me that we can know very much about anything that happened 2,000 years ago when we can't even believe everything we read in the New York Times today. The idea that any kind of accurate information could have arrived to us today from that time without there being something written down, without there being something physical, just strikes me as unbelievable. It just is the way that there could have been much known from that period if it hadn't been written down in black and white. And there were people, there were historians at that time. There were historians living in Jerusalem at that time that didn't write any of these events down. So it really looks suspicious to me that the story is all contrived, at least the mythical story, not necessarily the existence of a person, but the whole story built up around him.
Well, there are many ways one could go from that, but part of the issue is how far truth can be conveyed and transmitted in the community and in its life. You seem to regard words, things written down on paper, as the only thing that really matters.
Even better than that would be things found in the ground, physical objects. That would be better than stuff written down on paper.
You see, I'm interested in family history, and stories come down through families over several generations. And I've been prone to disbelieve many of these things that I've told, but having gone into the records, they're not usually right in the details. They get time wrong and the various other things, but there is always something there. And you see, you quote one particular incident, say, there are millions of them. We're talking about a tradition which is embodied in the life of a community, which I share in, and you don't because you've chosen not to.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be summing up our thoughts on today's programme. If you'd like to get in touch, as I say, as usual, the internet, the email address is unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also leave me a voicemail message, and I'll give you the details of how to do that a little later on as well. Don't forget our website, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, where you can hear today's programme again. You can send on to a friend. You can also get involved at the Premier community there. Lots of discussions going on in the Unbelievable forum. Between atheists, Christians and people of other faiths. So do encourage you to get online and check that out. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We'll be wrapping up our thoughts on today's programme in just a moment's time. Welcome back to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. Into the last segment of the show now. It's the show that gets Christians and non-Christians together every week here on Premier Christian Radio. Saturday afternoon right now, but you may be listening via the podcast, in which case it could be any day of the week at any time. And however you're listening, it's great to have you with me. But if you are listening this Saturday afternoon, then just a reminder that after this show, Hip Rock UK is with us. The very best in contemporary Christian music aimed at the youth market. And after that, we've got Loretta Fenton Presents presenting some of the best unsigned Christian music talent in the UK. For the moment, let me tell you what's coming up next week at the same time, if you want to tune in. We're going to be hearing a debate between John Tancock, who's a Welsh apologist, and he's coming over into the studio, and he's going to be talking to a person going by the name of B. Strong. It's a pen name, but they've written a book called Jesus is a Hoax. In it, they make some very interesting claims. He says that the Apostle Paul was mentally ill and that he was the proponent of effectively a hoax religion. Well, he's going to be contesting those claims. John Tancock joins me in the studio next week to do that discussion with B. Strong, who will be on the phone from the States. So do join us for that. Should be a really interesting one. Right now, time to get back into today's final part of our debates with Victor Stenger.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we're concluding our programme today. Victor Stenger, the atheist US physicist and author of God, the Failed Hypothesis, has joined me over the course of the last 2 weeks, and today talking to David Bartholomew, a Christian and emeritus professor of statistics at the London School of London School of Economics, even. So thanks, gentlemen, both for being with me today. It's been really great to get your interactions. Obviously, what you've been saying to some extent, David, is that we will, you know, we have different worldviews, we have different experiences, which give us, if you like, different analysis. You know, you both essentially, gentlemen, have the same range of statistics and data available in front of you. You draw one conclusion, which is God does not exist from it, Victor. The conclusion that David draws is different, that God does exist. There's certainly nothing to disprove God's existence in the data we see in front of us. I mean, someone might ask, you know, from the outset, is it even possible to put God in this context of, a kind of effect to be judged in this way or another? I mean, at the end of the day, surely God, to some extent, is more, if you are trying to establish whether God is there, Victor, is more than just a scientific phenomena to be observed. It's got to be more than that, hasn't it?
Well, that's absolutely true. You can imagine all kinds of gods that would not be detectable. The deist God, which incidentally is a God that more people actually believe in than you would think. Even the people who claim to be Christians They've been surveys now. Baylor University did a recent survey that showed that about 40% of the people who call themselves Christians actually didn't believe in a God that plays an important role in the universe and acts in their lives.
Don't believe in an interventionist God.
Yeah, so they're really deists, but they would not even know what the word deist means in general. So they still call themselves Christians. So you certainly have that, and the issue is whether you can deal with not a God of every conceivable variety, but the God that most people worship, a God, or at least the God of the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, a very active God, a God that plays an important role in the universe. And it's not that we are detecting anything about that God's nature when we do scientific experiments. What we're doing is we're looking for the phenomena that we would expect to result if such a God existed, actual physical phenomena that would take place. I haven't talked at all about many of the things that were in my book, where I argue that God should have shown up in the creation of the universe, in the design of nature, and so on. There are many, many other examples in the prayer. Prayer was not the only one. Revelation is another one, easily tested. If a person talks to God, if people have talked to God over the centuries, over the millennia, then somebody must have come back with some information that they could not possibly have known before. That's certainly a testable phenomenon. You could test everybody who has a claimed religious experience and see what they learned from that religious experience, and then go and find out if it has anything to do with reality.
Is the problem, though, that God, people's religious experience doesn't happen in the laboratory conditions of a test. It happens in normal life, where
suppose somebody came back and predicted the exact date of the next Los Angeles earthquake, just something like that. It would be hard to, again, give a natural explanation for this. And this is what I claim, that these are all phenomena that you wouldn't expect to work every time, but you'd expect the billions of times that people have prayed, the billions of times that people have had religious experiences, at some place, sometime, there would have been some result that could have been tested scientifically.
But I suppose this is the problem, isn't it, that given the fact that there have probably been billions of prayers offered to God, I'm sure there are equally billions of people who claim they've heard from God, but it can't be subjected to a scientific test because it didn't happen in that environment. I mean, David, do you feel that anecdotal evidence, as it were, is a valid way of looking for God, even though we can't necessarily put it to the... let's ask David what he thinks.
Yeah.
Well, I'm beginning to regret introducing the word anecdotal, because there is a quality of evidence around, vast amounts, which I agree individually don't count for very much. It's when they're taken all together that the case begins to weigh up. I don't think Christian belief really rests ultimately on the kind of evidence that Victor is looking for, so I don't think he's ever going to find it. And if someone were to come up and tell me the date of the next Los Angeles earthquake and it came to pass, I'd say, that's a funny sort of God. You know, that's not the kind of God I'm talking about. And I think this discussion, which I found very illuminating, has revealed a really fundamental difference between us about our conception of God. And unless we resolve that, we wouldn't get very much farther.
Great. Just ask you a question. You said that you talk about evidence and that it does not individually amount to much, but on the whole, that sounds like something that statistics call meta-analysis. You must know about meta-analysis. It's applied often in parapsychology. I've never seen a case of meta-analysis resulting in any major discovery. As far as I know, meta-analysis is a totally bankrupt way of trying to analyze data. You're the statistician. What's your answer to that?
I don't think it's true. I mean, meta-analysis is a big thing. There are conferences held on it. People go to it. And it arises because there are a vast number of studies of almost everything you like to. And somebody says, what does all this add up to? That's what meta-analysis is about.
Yes, yes.
Now, in the paper that Justin has referred to, I quoted an example you've given, because I don't think you've understood what it really is. You said, in effect, this is not what you said, but this is, if we had 10 cases, let's say, none of which were significant, how can we put those all together and say that is now significant? Mm-hmm. Well, you can, and there's a probability argument to show that you can do it. And I think the reason you've fallen into trouble on that is you regard these decisions made on the basis of significance tests as utterly and final, and without any question, they're not. There's an element of chance in, and it can happen that evidence is accumulated. Science proceeds by accumulating evidence. It does add up. It isn't a series of separate packets. It's a kind of cumulative picture that the scientific community is somehow initiated into.
Well, I have never seen a major discovery in physics made in that way. Every major discovery in physics that I know of was made by one individual experiment being beautifully done and statistically significant on its own right at a probability level of like 1 in 10,000 being a random effect. And then other people coming along. It's not necessary. That's not the final word. Other people then come along and try to do the same experiment, usually a little bit differently, but try to look for the same result. And when it's confirmed after several tests, then you believe in that phenomena. And that's every discovery I know of was discovered that way.
Well, I think it's your disadvantage, Victor, to be a physicist. Physics, in a sense, is relatively simple.
Yes,
you can
right.
control everything.
And I think
you can do experiments in a laboratory.
It fits in best in that situation because in physics, you're dealing with the most fundamental issues in the universe, the nature of matter and so on. And then with God, you're dealing certainly with one of the most fundamental issues in the universe. And the techniques that are used in physics should be the most applicable to the God question.
I just don't agree, I'm afraid.
What did you expect?
Well, absolutely. No, indeed. Very rarely do I expect much agreement in this studio. But thanks, gentlemen, for your fascinating interaction today. Is God a failed hypothesis, we asked today. We were looking at it from a statistical point of view, and we were looking at it last week from a philosophical point of view. Thanks, gentlemen, both for being... Now, there's a couple of books floating around in the studio at the moment. Obviously, Victor's one here, which I think he's just signing for David as we speak.
We're going to sign each other's... I'm sorry, that's not your... that's not my copy. Oh, sorry.
I'll give you that one.
We'll sign it for me, at least.
Well, yes, I'll sign that.
What are we signing here? So, Victor, you're signing David's... edition of the God the Failed Hypothesis. Now, David, what books have you written and that you will be signing for Victor?
I have this one at home. I was thinking, you sign it, but of course that's not my copy. I wish I had brought it.
That's the recent one, which we haven't discussed at all.
Yeah.
Well, give us the name of that so that people
It's called God, Chance and Purpose.
And who's that published by?
Cambridge University Press. And it has a subtitle, Can God Have It Both Ways? Publishers like subtitles nowadays.
They do,
subtitle that sells the book. And the real title.
This book was good because it had two subtitles.
But we'll put a link to that book on the website as well, David, so that people can find that.
That's old.
Just give us the title again of that latest book from Cambridge University Press.
God, Chance and Purpose.
Excellent. And that essentially continues your exploration of the role of God in science and data and statistics. So thank you very much, gentlemen, both for being with me on the programme. It's been fascinating to meet you, Victor.
Yes, a
safe trip back to the US, and I hope that maybe we'll get to talk again. Perhaps when this fine-tuning book comes out, we'll bring in a John Polkinghorne or an Alistair McGrath or someone.
Yes,
to debate you on that.
We get back to London quite a bit because my wife loves London, and so we get here.
Well, it would be great to see you next time you're in town. We could have a look at the fine-tuning arguments and the arguments for and against. And I hope you've enjoyed the programme today. Keep listening. We're going to round off today's programme with a look at your feedback and comments. For the moment, my thanks to my guests. And we'll see you again, hopefully, at another point in the future.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the 2 weeks that Victor has spent as our special guest here on Unbelievable as much as I have. And I'm sure many of you wanting to get in touch, many of you have been in touch as well. So why don't I go through some of the responses I received in regard to last week's programme. A couple of people drawing me up on my presenting style of last week's programme, suggesting that I became too involved myself on the side of the Christian argument. This one in particular from Matt says, on the broadcast, Is God a Failed Hypothesis, Programme 1, I felt that the debate between Stenger and Fuller, and you may remember it was Steve Fuller, our guest last week, debating Victor, you say it was an unfair debate. Mr. Stenger not only had to debate Mr. Fuller, but also had to debate the interviewer of the debate. Mr. Stenger should have never have agreed to this debate. Well, it's interesting you feel that way. I don't think Victor particularly saw me as, you know, going for him too much. I like to pride myself on hopefully being somewhat neutral. Obviously, I am a Christian myself, but I hope I give a fair crack of the whip to both sides. Step in when necessary on either side, in a way. But also someone else, and I'll come to that email later, felt that I lost my usual neutrality. Xander, who's a regular emailer to the show and an atheist, says, after looking into this, I see that Steve Fuller didn't make any sense whatsoever. He doesn't actually claim to be a scientist, but still, his view that without God there's no good reason to do science is just patently absurd. The deism of great thinkers such as Newton is quite different than theism, and besides, there are plenty of atheists who are quite happy to do scientific research, and plenty of atheist non-scientists such as me who are thankful for the progress of science, in spite of the negative aspects that come with it. This was, of course, in response to Steve Fuller's contention last week that science has always historically been done within the context of a Christian worldview, and that it really owes its the actual quest for understanding and knowledge is because we have in mind that there is some objective aim, some goal, some purpose out there that a transcendent God is the best explanation for. Well, Xander took issue with that. Let's hear from someone on the phone who took issue with that as well.
Hi, Justin. It's Alex from Peterhead. I just wanted to take issue with something that your Christian guest Stevens said. Specifically his insistence that science is somehow reliant on Christian principles, belief in God, whatever. I think the key questions are, how many scientific experiments could not be successfully carried out by an atheist? I think it's none. And how many applications for scientific funding require mention of God? Well, none. The fact that our world is governed by certain laws and principles, I think is something empirically testable, and the assumption that they apply uniformly elsewhere in the universe is an inference from observation and evidence, not something we need theologians to tell us. And I don't think it matters if a scientist's reason for rolling out of bed in the morning is to serve the Lord. The important question is whether the science requires God or belief in God to be of use to us. And I think the evidence is clear that it doesn't. Anyway, thanks for another interesting debate.
Thank you very much, Alex, for getting in touch. 08456 52 52 52. If you want to do the same by phone, select option 8 when you get there. 08456 52 52 52. I mean, I would say I don't think Steve is in any way suggesting that science can't work. You know, you have to be a Christian to be able to do good science. That wasn't the point of his argument at all. I think it was more that atheism would be a block to science in terms of the if that had been the, if you like, the hothouse in which science had developed. He just didn't think that actually gives a kind of an end view that makes science work. Obviously, it's a controversial view, but we do host them here on the show. Jacob M. says, if you could ask your guests, what does the art in science tell us, for example, of the placement of the eyes, the nose, the ears, etc.? We needed eyes, one in front and one on the back of the head, would increase our chances of survival and so on. But who's responsible for the perfect placement and beauty of these things? Interesting question, Jacob. I'm not quite sure where you're getting at with that. Where are you suggesting that, in a sense, there's a beauty that we recognise to our faces which isn't actually necessarily advantageous to our survival? I'm not quite sure where you're coming from with that one. Here's Matt, though. Matt works in the whole area of science. great to have you listening to the show, Matt. You say you listen to it weekly now for the last 6 months and have found it very helpful personally. You say, I'm a molecular biologist with a doctorate and several years research in a postdoctorate position. So I found the discussion on is God a failed hypothesis particularly interesting. I hope you found today's interesting as well, Matt. You say, a couple of points I'd like to make. I'm a Christian and I approach my science in pretty much the way that Steve Fuller suggests. My investigation of molecular biology is fueled by my desire to understand God. The fantastic beauty that I find in biology fits perfectly with my understanding of a mighty creator. So Victor Stenger's assertion that someone like me has to have my science and my religion in two separate halves of my brain is just plain wrong and insulting. Never mind that many pioneers of science had the same attitude. And I know some colleagues who see it as I do, and I'm not even American or living in America. Actually, it was this point of Victor's that just made me respond by email. I couldn't not respond. I won't respond to all of the points that Victor made that I thought needed correcting. Steve did a fair job, I thought, and you too, when you almost forgot to be an objective moderator. But towards the end of the discussion, Victor claimed that the God explanation is a science stopper, and Steve didn't address this point. Well, what Victor doesn't seem to understand is that science is a quest for explanations, and when it finds a good explanation for a particular phenomenon, it will stop any further search. In that sense, science is trying to end itself, ultimately. If we had perfect knowledge, I, as a scientist, would be out of a job. The claim that the God explanation is a science stopper is also very simplistic. It isn't as though the pioneers of science, most of whom were theists of one strain or another, simply dropped their hands and walked away from science. Rather, their view of God guided their science, not stopped it. Actually, the same could be said of much of atheistic explanations. In my own area of research, for example, the idea that most of our genomes are just junk DNA meant that research on that junk was apparently pointless. It guided people away from studying the junk. But thanks to maverick scientists, we are now in a position of questioning whether there really is any junk DNA. In fact, some of the most important regulatory elements in our genome are recovered from the so-called junk DNA. For me personally, I could never happily reconcile junk DNA with a creator God. And this has definitely prevented me from making the same mistake and treating DNA as junk. This has saved me quite a lot of time in my research program. So to summarize my point here, the claim that the God explanation stops science is too simplistic. It would be more accurate to say that it can guide science, just as atheistic assumptions can also guide science, for better or worse. Well, thank you. You say it was a long email, and feel free to ignore any part of it, but I actually read the whole thing there, Matt. Really interesting. Thank you for your interactions there. Quite a bit of reaction there to that show of last week with Victor Stenger. Thanks to all those who have emailed in. And don't forget this week's show with Victor and David Bartholomew. We'd appreciate your thoughts on that too. What did you think of David's critique of Victor's approach, his approach to trying to assess scientifically the odds that God exists, given the experiments that have been conducted along those lines? As usual, email address unbelievable@premier.org.uk. There's also a good discussion going on at the Unbelievable Forum in regard to Stenger's appearance on the programme. If you want to check that out, just go to the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Click through to the Premier community via the icon there, and you will find a whole range of debates going on at the Unbelievable group of the Premier community, including that one on Stenger's appearance last week. Okay, let's just quickly see if we can squeeze in a couple in regard to that show, those shows on homosexuality we did about a month or so ago now. Still getting your feedback on that. Thanks very much to Nick, who got in touch to say he wanted to address one of the non-Christians who wrote in to say that homosexual behaviour shows up in the animal world, so therefore we should see it as natural. Nick says, I say, very well, so does the eating of one's own young. Do you want to see us to see that as normal and natural? I really don't think the animal world is the world to take our moral cues from. You also wanted to take issue with the writer who complained about the nature of this programme. That was a Christian writer who said that we don't have enough biblically conservative views on the programme, and and you wanted to say, Nick, you felt that was unfair, and that if you want a biblically conservative view anyway, you've been on the program, and you'd be happy to come back on. And also on the issue of homosexuality, Nick Quinn wrote in to say that he really enjoyed the programs. Mike Dark was the professing Christian who is also gay, and you say you absolutely loved his attitude whilst talking to John Richardson on the topic of homosexuality. But you say, emotionally, I too understand and would like the Bible to condone homosexuality because I feel it is part of the identity of many struggling believers. But I cannot justify, and I think you meant Mike here, presumably, in the context of what you're saying. I cannot justify Mike's position using the biblical text, although I do appreciate his ministry and support his love for people and God. Anyway, thank you very much for getting in touch, Nick. If I have misunderstood your comment there on the homosexuality, do get in touch again. But you also wrote in about biblical slavery, which was a program of a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to save that over for next time because we're out of time right now. So thank you for getting in touch, and don't forget, as I say, the email address, and I do try to respond personally to any new emailer. Do tell me as well where you're listening and how you came across the show. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to hearing from you. And you can look forward to another edition of Unbelievable at the same time next week. Back to the sort of bread and butter of this show. We're asking, is Christianity a hoax?
You're unbelievable.
And we're asking that in the context of one particular skeptic was a Christian, now not a Christian, and you'll find out why next week. He's going to be joining us by phone from the States. B. Strong is his pen name. He's written a book called Jesus is a Hoax. In particular, we'll be looking at his claim that the Apostle Paul was mentally ill, and he was the proponent of this hoax religion. We'll be finding out why B. Strong believes that. In a conversation with him, John Tancock, who's an apologist from Wales. So you can expect an interesting discussion next week between these two guys. So I do hope you can join me at the same time as per usual. In the meantime, have a great week. And I look forward to seeing you at the same time here on the show that gets you thinking.